Session number 11208.
Mr. Eric Hooper, Reel 5. We were talking about the trip out to Port Tewfik on the Orduna in convoy. Do you remember any of the events of the trip from when you started off at Greenock?
Yes. There was one particular time that our steering went wrong, and we were all over the place. When you came down, when we came down in the morning for breakfast, in fact, before breakfast, I used to have a walk around the deck, and all our convoy were quite a distance in front of us, and we could see where we were going round in circles, where the steering hadn't gone foot. That was put right, and then we another particular time. This would be about probably 2 or 3 weeks after that. Again in the morning, came to have a stroll around the deck, and we were on our own. Pardon, when I say on our own, all our the warships, the companies, they were all missing. They had gone, and then we saw a plane come along, and it dropped a bomb just beside our ammunition ship, which fortunately missed. But what had happened then, I've been told, was that our accompanying destroyers, etc., they had gone in search of the Bismarck, which we had. Ajax was one of our ships. Ajax, no, what was it? I've forgotten the name of the other one now. I just can't remember offhand what the other one was. But, oh yes, another time, yes.
Were you able to follow the Bismarck thing, and did you know what was happening?
No,
did the Hood thing have any impact on
you? No, we didn't know anything about that until it was, in fact, months after that, I mean, when we were ashore. And also the Achilles was the other one we had with us, that's right, Ajax and the Achilles. Now, we used to use one of the swords. Swordfish, that's one of the planes they had. We used to use that for the training exercises for the Bren gunners, who were in charge of the Bren, and their job was to attack any low-flying aircraft. But unfortunately, what happened one day, that something had gone wrong, and the plane crashed into the sea, and the pilot was decapitated. And that was a very sad occasion. And then another one before we got to Durban, about a week before we got to Durban, we had trouble with the steering again, and this was during the night, and I suddenly heard this sort of shud and crash, and we'd been rammed by another one of the ships, and we had a hole. Fortunately, it was above the low water mark, and we put in the Durban to have that repaired.
Were you conscious at all of the submarine risk, especially during the start of the journey?
Well, you know, to be quite honest, as far as I was concerned, I wasn't worried about that, and I don't think the troops were either. You know, the morale was very good. We never thought about anything like that.
So what happened when you got to Durban? They were doing repairs.
We were allowed to go ashore from a certain time in the morning until a certain time at night.
Oh, so you carried on being billeted, so to speak, on the ship?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, you're billeted on the ship, but you had to... I can't remember what the time was. I think somewhere about 10 o'clock you were allowed off board, and then... I know as an officer, I just can't remember what time the men had to be back. But we had to be back by about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, that's a fair amount of leeway.
Oh, yes, that's all right, yes.
What would you do ashore?
Well, there was always quite a lot of ladies at the gates, willing to take the men, you know, entertain the men for the period they were there. There was another officer now, a very friendly, his name was Rumble. Unfortunately, he's dead now. He wasn't killed during the war, but he died probably about 2 years ago, I think. He and I used to go together, and all we did, we'd find a club somewhere and have a few beers, And I remember one particular night we were coming back to the ship, and a car stopped us and asked us what time we had to be back aboard ship. And we told them. He said, well, would you like to come for a run in the car? Well, we had been told to be very wary of anybody speaking in a guttural accent, because they were picking up officers and taking them away, and that's the last you heard of them. But we were both armed, and this bloke seemed quite a reasonable fellow, so right, we said, come on, we'll go with him. Well, he took us for a run round the Durban racetrack, and then he said, would you like a drink? Well, we seemed a bit funny, but anyway, he said, come on, we'll have a drink. So he took us to his house, which was really a mansion, big double doors, and he said, come on, have a look round the house. And took us into the billiard room, where he had a full billiard table, and I noticed in particular he had a nice bookcase. And on that bookcase, on the ledge, was a book on British birds. And I just stopped and looked at that particular book. And then afterwards he said, come on, have a drink. And he took us into a study. And then he said, you know, you've been a bit dubious about me. I said, well, we have. Well, look, he said, you see that? And he pointed to a framed certificate on the wall. And it happened, his name was Anderson, and he was the Danish consul, elected Danish consul of Durban by the British government. And after that, we were quite happy. We had drinks and cigars, and then he said, do you remember where the billiard room is? I said, yes. He said, you know the book you looked at? I said, yes. He said, would you like it? I said, well, it's very kind of you. He said, well, go and get it. So I went and got the book, and he signed it. He looked at an almanac first of all. He signed it and he gave it to me. Now, I've got that book now. And if you'd like to have a look at it, I can show it to you. Really?
Later, yes.
Yes, and because in the front it's got quite an interesting reading that he wrote.
This business about officers being taken, was that just a warning, or did you actually lose some officers?
We never lost any, no. We never lost any, but that was a warning.
Did you have any official parades or anything ashore?
Yes, we
or
had
any training.
We had one parade in Durban, which was a march past in the sports field at Durban. And we, of course, march at the light infantry pace. So therefore, we were last to go on parade. And there was a lull of about 10 minutes before we went on parade, because it was such a big parade, because it was the whole parade of the 50th Northumbrian Division. And therefore, there was a lot of troops on parade. So we came along, and of course we were well received, particularly with the light infantry pace.
All three battalions?
All three battalions, oh, yes, all three battalions.
Did you do any training ashore?
Oh no, we weren't there long enough. We were only there for about 2 or 3 days. And then
The civilian population generally were very friendly?
Oh, very, very friendly. Very friendly indeed.
So from Durban?
Well, Durban, we went back, and we stopped at Aden for 24 hours to take on water and oil.
Did you get ashore?
Well, the officers got ashore, much to the dislike of the troops. Of course, when we were going ashore, the going down the galley, the troops were swearing, they were throwing things at us, you know. And when I look back, it was all wrong, really. But the point was, there were so many troops that could, you know, if they got ashore, because we were only allowed ashore for 2 or 3 hours, and I'm sure if they got ashore, they would never got back in time. So we got ashore, and it was quite a nice little interlude. I mean, we went to a little pub there, or a hotel, which was called the Crescent Hotel, and I can remember that quite distinctly. Marble floor, what have you, and the native waiters. And after that, there was a naval officer came in, And we finished up at the Naval Officers Mess in Aden. But it's a place, man, I wouldn't like to have stopped any length of time.
Why not?
Very, very, very hot. It was commonly known by the troops who were stationed there. It was the gateway to hell.
So after 24 hours?
Well, we went up to the... up to the Red Sea. Now we anchored in the middle of the Red Sea for about 24 hours because we were waiting to go to Tewfik to be offloaded. Now we had one ship in our convoy, which was the Georgic, and that had a contingent of the nursing sisters aboard, so they were allowed off first. So this is the reason why we were anchored, to allow them to be offloaded, and then we were going to go ashore. But unfortunately, they got all the troops off the Georgic, beg your pardon, the Georgic, when a German plane came along and dropped a bomb down the funnel of the Georgic and set fire to it. So therefore, we were there for 2 or 3 days, and that was absolutely hell because it was absolutely midsummer and the heat was terrific. And it was. I've never, people talk about, oh, they can stand plenty of heat, but this was absolutely deadly. I'd rather have had the cold than the heat.
What was it like below decks?
Oh, terrible, terrible. It was bad enough on deck. What we used to do on the night time, we used to, even though in our bunks, I wouldn't say that. Our cabin was air conditioned. We did have a fan, but that wasn't strong enough to keep you cool. And we used to just go upstairs and lie on the deck.
Were the troops allowed on deck?
Some of them were, but there wasn't room for everybody.
So after a couple of days, you unloaded, you disembarked.
Yes, at Tewfik, and what we had there was.
That was early July 1941.
Yes. What we had there was a cup of, a mug of tea and sandwiches and what have you. And then we boarded a train to take us up to Kassassin.
Was there any trouble while you were unloading?
Well, yes. What happened was I suddenly saw CMP take out his revolver and fire it. And
that's Company Military Police?
Yes, Corps of Military Police.
Oh, Corps of
Military. Corps of Military Police, yes. And and I suddenly saw this a native. He'd gone to loot a train, and he just took this revolver and shot this native.
He hit him?
He hit him, yes. Whether he killed him, I don't know, but he fell to the ground. But apparently this is the sort of thing they had to do, because we found later on that you had to be very, very wary of these natives. Because
did it shock you at the time?
I was amused, really. Not shocked, I was just amused.
So after you disembarked, that's when you went to El Qasim, is it?
I went over, yes, this is it. And we arrived there in the dark, and we were allotted an area. But although it had been an advance party sent forward to assist in erecting the camp, they hadn't all the tents erected, and a lot of us just had to sort of camp down on the desert overnight, and then we had to have the tents erected the next morning.
What kind of a tent were they? What was it like, tent life? Because you stayed in the tents till you went off to Cyprus.
Oh yes. Oh, the tents were, it was spacious. They weren't the bell tents like the First World War. They were the what were they called? Indian tents, European pattern, or was it Indian pattern, European tents? But they were like small marquees with a fly sheet above to keep off, to make a air vent, so it was air going all around the tent.
And how many officers to a tent, how many men? Roughly.
Well, how many do we have now? We had about three officers to our tent. Sometimes it was four. Depends how many officers you had with your platoon, you see, or with your company. With the troops they had, they were about 10.
And how did you adapt to the heat and to the desert conditions?
I think they adapted fairly well, unfortunately, but we all got a dose of jippy tummy while we were there. I don't think there was a person who didn't go down with it.
Did you know what the cause was?
Yes. It was caused by infestation of flies.
Flies.
Oh yes, flies was the. There's more people who went down with jippy tummy than anything else, because flies are a filthy insect. I mean, we were given lectures on flies, and you were told of the habits that a fly. If it was a cube of sugar, a fly would spit onto that sugar, and then suck up the juices. And then to eat more, it would either vomit, but it would keep on eating, and they would excrete amongst on the sugar as well. And you couldn't actually see all you could see a fly on it, but you know what was happening. And of course, this is what caused your trouble.
So the flies were getting on your food.
On their food, oh yes, food before it's cooked and after it's cooked, and it was an offence for. For anybody to pour water on the desert, you know, even though you drank a glass of something and it was, and you know, he just drops it, he did it on the desert, you could be crowned for that.
Why?
Because that helped to sustain the flies and keep the flies alive. The flies went for that water because they wanted water.
Were there any active measures other than that to sort of try and reduce the number of flies?
Oh yes, you had from Corps headquarters, you had hygiene sections went round lecturing on hygiene, how to keep the flies down, and you know, issued with flit and flit guns. In fact, at night time, you'd go into your tent, and your tent was absolutely black with flies on the tent. You know, sleeping for the night.
What were these flick guns? Sorry.
They were good, like a spray gun with insecticide, but the insecticide was called flit in those days. I don't know if you can get flit now, but I suppose you can get flit or something similar now. And well, you can't you? Get them in the spray cans. But we had mosquito nets, and what we had, we put our ground sheets on the floor, you know, for just as a carpet, you know, and used to spray the roof and then get into your underneath your net quick, and you could hear these flies buzzing and just woof, dropping onto the ground sheet, and there was thousands of them.
Was there any other pests?
There was mosquitoes, which you only got those if when you were near anywhere where there's a lot of water. You know, they went for damp conditions.
So that wasn't a problem at El Cassim much.
Well, that came in more or less when we got up to Tunisia in that area.
We'll talk about that then, yes. What about things like scorpions and that sort of thing? Or snakes? Were there any of that in the area?
No, I only saw one snake, but I saw a lot of scorpions. But scorpions wouldn't touch you unless you touched them. But most of the time, scorpions they hid themselves underneath stones, shelter themselves from the midday sun. There's a lot of stones, you know, if you lifted them up you'd see one or two scorpions.
So they weren't a bother to you?
They weren't bothered, no.
Did you actually do any desert training, you know, because marching in the desert isn't the same as marching, any of that sort of thing, or transport?
We did that when we went to Cyprus, because from when we were at Kassassin, we were there for 2 or 3 weeks. Now, I just can't remember how many weeks we were there. You know,
you were there, it was about two, because you left in, you arrived in July and left in July. Yeah. Did you do any training at all at Cassim?
No. we'll just get everybody's more or less getting themselves, shall we say, acclimatized to the heat, because as I say, most of them were under the weather for a week or so, because this jippy tummy was hell. We just like dysentery, really.
So when did you hear of the Cyprus trip?
Well, what happened was we just got special orders that we had to be ready to move off by a certain time.
Was it a rush move?
Oh yes, we moved at darkness and went to I think it was Alexander, where we went aboard a cruiser. I did know the name of the cruiser now. I just forgot it offhand.
Was it Leander?
Leander was the cruiser. That's right, Leander. That's right. Which was a New Zealand vessel, and we rushed across to Cyprus because they thought at that particular time Crete had just recently fallen, and they thought that the Germans were going to invade Cyprus, and our job there was to put the island on a state of defence. And although we didn't have the full division there, it was a certain amount of camouflage to induce the enemy to think that they did have a division guarding the island.
Do you remember the trip on the Leander? Because it was a rush affair.
No, just the trip. I was very lucky. I met somebody there who he and I had something in common, and he was an officer, and he said he was going in watch, so he let me have his cabin for the night, and so I was very, very lucky, whereas the rest of them had to sleep on the deck or wherever they were put.
Where did you land? Do you remember the
landed, yes, we landed at Famagusta.
Was there anything, did they rush the disembarkation?
Oh yes, it was rushed, yes, and then from Famagusta we were put on trains and we went to Nicosia, and from Nicosia we marched from Nicosia up to where we were, to our area, which was between Panalakatamia and, what was the other one?
Lakatamia?
It was Lakatamia, but it was Pana, one word, it was both Lakatamias, but one word was Pana. And I've got another one. It means upper and lower Lakatamia. Panalakatamia. I just can't remember the. Can't remember offhand.
And what? Where were you billeted? What?
We're just billeted in tents.
Now, were you still with the headquarter committee? Company.
No. By then, I was with the A company.
When had you been transferred to them?
I got transferred to them when we landed at Cyprus.
So mm-hmm. You took over, and you were a platoon commander.
Platoon commander, yes.
Mm-hmm. So you were in tents.
Yes.
And what was the role of the battalion or your company platoon?
Well, every company was allotted a certain area, or a company area as they call them, and we were allotted platoon positions from then, and you had to dig yourself in to a set plan. You slip trenches, and then you had your little platoon command, or your command headquarters for your platoon. And also, it was each particular company area or platoon area had what they call an all-round defence. It wasn't just facing one particular area; it was all-round defence, so they could. If they were attacked anywhere by parachutes, they could defend anywhere.
Were the company positions interlinked at all? I mean,
they weren't interlinked by any slit trench, by any communication trenches. It was just a case of, I suppose if we'd been any longer, that would have developed, because this is what happens is, you see, you were like the First World War, where you had the communication trenches, they all started from a slit trench. And they developed from then. The length of time you were there, you get the development. But the first thing you did was a slip trench to get yourself underground.
These are all round positions. Did you use wire, barbed wire, or mines?
We didn't use any mines then, because we weren't there long enough. there was a certain amount of danad wiring used.
And, what was that?
Well, it's it was sort of it's like a coil of wire, and it comes out here, and you pull it all out like that. It was I think the French more or less invented it, I think.
So you set up these positions, and what did you do then? Just occupy the position?
No, you just occupied the position, and at night time you stood to an hour before sunset, and in the morning an hour before sunrise. And then in the morning after that, you went for a run, and then you did PT, and you had breakfast. And incidentally, what happened was that I think I'm jumping the gun here, that when we first went to start digging these trenches, we were all withdrawn before first light. But the areas had to be camouflaged before we left. So if a spotted plane had come across, they couldn't see what we were doing.
How did you camouflage? What did you use?
Well, we used camouflage nets, and if we found any scrub, anything, anywhere about, we just stuck that on. And then we came back, and we had breakfast, and then we slept until about tiffin time. Lunch was called in those days in the desert, tiffin time. And then there wasn't much actual weapon training, that sort of thing. You had your meal. No, in other words, all you did was work on your defences, eat and sleep.
Now, when the defence works got ready, were ready, how did the routine change then?
Well, when it got ready, we used to we lived in them, and then the troops were allowed local leave after tea time, which was after 4 o'clock. To Nicosia, and there was tricks laid on, and of course they weren't all let off. There was always a nucleus left there, of course, for emergency, and that went on until.
How did the troops behave in Nicosia?
They behaved reasonably well, but there was an order came round that the troops had to refrain from referring to the natives of these effing Cypriots. But otherwise, they got on reasonably well.
Did the troops not like the Cypriots much?
Well, I don't know. I can't understand why they didn't. I found them quite reasonable.
What about drink? Was that a problem? Because they've got some fairly
You did have the one or two problems, and I'm afraid to say you had the same problem with officers as well, getting too much, because the drink there was the pretty potent stuff. You know, they had the Cypriot wines, Commander Era, Aphrodite, and quite reasonable. You know, probably about 20p a bottle sort of style, or I would say the equivalent of about 2 shillings a bottle.
And what sort of trouble did drink lead to with the men, at least, first?
Well, they were picked up by the Corps of Military Police and put inside until they cooled down, and then they were taken back to battalion headquarters where they were punished by the CO.
Did it lead to any trouble with the civilians when they were drunk?
Well, I couldn't say there was I wouldn't say there was a great deal of trouble.
Fighting, really.
No. There was just the nuisance value, really.
What about troops making passes at Cypriot women and that sort of thing? Did that lead to any trouble, or were they warned
off?
No. How about, you mentioned that some of the officers got the worse for wear. How did that, and what did that...
Well, there's one particular officer. He went into a certain club, and he took out his pistol and started shooting the place up. and that particular bloke was given a nickname. I won't give you his Christian name, but he was called Arizona somebody. And For that particular reason, he was confined to barracks for quite a considerable time.
Were many officers like that?
No,
or?
No.
That's an extreme.
An extreme, that, yes. No.
Well, did you go out drinking much?
No, I didn't, as a matter of fact. I wasn't one for spirits. I liked my beer, but beer was very expensive. It was more, you know, it was probably somewhere, I would say, equivalent of about